From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Lydon. This episode, where we are on stand your ground laws. An original creator says he's uneasy.
I'll be quite frank with you. I have been mystified by some of the rulings that have come out of this.
And Senator Kirsten Gillibrand on her proposed legislation to curb sexual assault in the military.
These are violent crimes perpetrated by often predators who are recidivists, and these are crimes of domination and violence.
Also, remembering the historic African-American unit, the 54th Massachusetts Regiment, which attacked Fort Wagner 150 years ago. And 44 years after a moonwalk, are we looking at a park up there?
The issue that the legislation tries to address is, in fact, actually a real one.
Plus John Dufresne's wildly new crime novel, No Regrets, Coyote.
I tell you I'm going to lie to you, and then I lie to you, and you believe it because you want to believe.
A noir thriller set in South Florida. And Milton's poetry gets a new twist from Grant Hart of the 80s band Husker Du. That's all coming up on this podcast of Weekends on All Things Considered. Since last week's acquittal of George Zimmerman for the murder of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin, there have been many protests expressing anger at the verdict. Today, in New York City and across the country, they continued.
I am Trayvon Martin!
Yesterday, President Obama publicly reacted to the verdict for the first time. Shireen Marisol Meraji of NPR's Code Switch team has more.
Devin Woods lives with his dad in the Nickerson Garden housing projects in South Los Angeles. At 13, he's well aware that life is not going to be easy.
You know, everybody gets killed around here, and we're all just like Trayvon. And it's just that, just without the media and stuff like that.
Yesterday, President Barack Obama spoke to the media and said something similar.
When Trayvon Martin was first shot, I said that this could have been my son. Another way of saying that is Trayvon Martin could have been me.
The nation's first black president talked about what it's like to be a black man in America. People locking their car doors when you pass, women clutching their purses when you step into an elevator. He talked about how poverty, dysfunction, and violence in black neighborhoods can be traced back to a very difficult history in this country, all to make a point. There's context for why black people are upset about Trayvon Martin, and understanding that might help us all move forward.
Beyond protests or vigils, the question is, are there some concrete things that we might be able to do?
The president talked about legislation to curb racial profiling. He said we could look at laws like Stand Your Ground and see who they protect and who they don't. And he said we need to find a way to show African-American boys that their country cares about them. Back at the Nickerson Garden housing projects in South L.A., 13-year-old Devin Woods has a suggestion.
We need to strengthen our judicial system so that we can depend on it more.
Shireen Marisol Meraji, NPR News.
As we just heard, the president pointedly addressed the self-defense law known as Stand Your Ground.
If Trayvon Martin was of age and armed, could he have stood his ground on that sidewalk?
And that's our cover story today, where we stand on Stand Your Ground. In Florida, the law expands the use of deadly force into the public sphere with no obligation to back down. To understand why Florida is the birthplace of the Stand Your Ground law, we go back nearly a decade to late summer of 2004.
Florida, and we think the storm will move in on Thursday morning, and it will most likely be a major hurricane.
Tremendous wind and sheets of rain continue to come on down. You can hear the wind howling.
Hurricane Ivan is now starting to lash the panhandle of Florida.
That summer, hurricanes ravaged Florida, killing dozens and causing billions in damage. Hurricane Ivan struck in late September. Dennis Baxley was then and is now a state representative in Florida, and he remembers that summer all too well.
We had a lot of properties in disarray. We had a number of people trying to prevent their property from being looted and also just nowhere to go.
That included a 77-year-old retiree named James Workman and his wife, Kathy. The storm left the couple's house mostly unlivable, so the Workmans left for a few weeks. In that period after the hurricane, Florida's Gulf Coast had a huge influx of cleanup workers and also looters and itinerants who took shelter in semi-abandoned homes like the Workmans. The couple returned to their home in early November. The night they got back, they slept in a FEMA trailer parked in the driveway. While they were sleeping, Workman said that his wife, Kathy, awoke to the sound of a stranger fumbling at the front door of their vacant house.
He was trying to get in this house, trying to get in this door. And so she hollered at him, and we hollered at him, and went outside and tried to get him to leave.
Back in 2006, Workman told that story to WEAR, a local TV news channel in Pensacola. He'd gone to investigate, he said, and the man appeared to leave, but actually he was heading for their trailer.
After I saw him enter that trailer, then I naturally went in there behind him. And so he was between Kathy and me. And we got into a scuffle, and I could tell it wasn't going to be easy. And so I just had to shoot him.
In the scuffle, the intruder had wrapped the 77-year-old Workman in a bear hug. Workman said he fired his shot in self-defense, but to the police and the state attorney, the circumstances were unclear. It took nearly 3 months for the state attorney's office to decide whether James Workman would face charges. In the end, he didn't. But the period of limbo was unacceptable to some Florida legislators, including Dennis Baxley. Just weeks after that decision, he co-sponsored the Stand Your Ground law in the Florida House of Representatives.
What I had envisioned is that a law-abiding citizen, if attacked, would feel fully empowered to stop a violent act.
More from Dennis Baxley later on. Florida, as everywhere, had always had a self-defense law. What Stand Your Ground changed was that you could now use deadly force anywhere you happened to be legally standing without having to try to run away. The law passed overwhelmingly in April 2005 and took effect that October. Chris Hundley is an investigative reporter for the Tampa Bay Times. She remembers that time, and she says the bill was not without criticism.
There were many complaints that the law was very vaguely written and confusing to police, prosecutors, judges, and juries.
And after the Trayvon Martin shooting in 2012, her newspaper published an investigation of every case in the state where Stand Your Ground had been invoked. They looked at about 200 cases.
We found that nearly 70% of the people who used a Stand Your Ground defense had gone free. 35% were not even charged by prosecutors. 23% were given immunity by the judge, and this is a special feature of the Stand Your Ground law, that you can go before the judge and argue Stand Your Ground pretrial and then be given immunity, which basically dismisses the case.
As you took a look at this, how did race play in, or did it?
The race question was murky. If you look at the victims, cases of fatalities, we found that defendants who were claiming Stand Your Ground were more likely to prevail if the victim was black. 73% of those who killed a black person faced no penalty, and that compared to 59% of those who killed a white person. When you look at the race of the victim, it's one thing. Interestingly, if you look at the defendants, we found that white defendants who invoked the law were charged at the same rate as blacks. Whites who went to trial were convicted at the same rate as blacks. But remember, most of the cases we found were same race. It was white on white and black on black. We found only less than a dozen mixed race cases.
Obviously, from your reporting, there are times when judges feel frustrated by the law. You write about a case in Leon County, and you write about this judge, Terry Lewis, in 2010. He's trying to find out what happened in basically a gang shootout. Can you tell me about that?
Right. This was a case in which a 15-year-old boy was killed in a gang shootout in Tallahassee. And the judge said he had no choice but grant immunity to two men who fired the AK-47 that was responsible for that death, even though they fired 25 to 30 times. And the reason he had to grant them immunity was because it couldn't be proven that they had fired first. And in fact, there were observers who said that it was a small handgun fire that they heard first. So the killers went free.
Chris Hundley of the Tampa Bay Times. Dennis Baxley is the Florida state representative from Ocala who helped author the Stand Your Ground law back in 2005. I talked with him about the application of this law since then, including that case.
You could not be doing anything unlawful. So I don't see this law as appropriately applied, using it with gang members or in pursuit and confront or following people away from a crime and creating a confrontation.
He concedes that the application of the law sometimes makes him uneasy.
I'll be quite frank with you. I have been mystified by some of the rulings that have come out of this, knowing the intent that went into this bill.
Baxley notes that Stand Your Ground was not explicitly mentioned in George Zimmerman's trial, though the language of the law was included in the jurors' instructions, and it's overshadowed the entire case.
The hide was pulled back on a much broader issue, and that is everyone equally treated before the law? And I think that's why so many people identify with the case. That and a horrific outcome. No one wishes for anyone to die a violent death, and particularly in such a needless situation.
So you would agree that the death of Trayvon Martin was a needless one?
I think it was a needless death. From all the facts that I saw demonstrated in the case, it became clear that he was unnecessarily treated with suspicion, and I think it angered him, and I think it would anger me to be treated needlessly with suspicion. But instead of doing what he had a right to do, which is to walk home, out of his anger, I think he did return for a fight, and that turned out horribly.
Let me ask you this. You say that you yourself have been mystified as to how this has been applied in a number of cases. As you think about all this, is there any adjustment that you would give to this law?
My position on it is I'm not immutable. I'm listening. I'm very admiring of the restraint that the Martin family has demonstrated. But yes, of course, we should be responsive and listen and look at what we have. Right now, I would be cautious because there are people advocating the repeal of the statute, dramatically diminishing its effectiveness. And I'm concerned for the people of Florida and our guest that we don't want to diminish for law-abiding citizens their ability to protect themselves from harm. And 70% of Floridians agree with me.
Florida State Representative Dennis Baxley. More than 30 states have now passed a Stand Your Ground law identical or similar to Florida's. And just hours before the president's impromptu statement yesterday, Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois asked to hold hearings on the laws. Those hearings likely will be held in September. Coming up, The Atlantic's James Fallows on the politics of President Obama's comments yesterday and the latest news from Detroit. This is NPR News. It's weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. The Pentagon estimates that there were 26,000 sexual assaults in the military last year alone. The Congress is divided over how to fix the problem, and in a body that's been known for its partisan battles, last week an unusual alliance was made. Republican Rand Paul signed on to a Senate bill brought by Democrat Kirsten Gillibrand, and he urged his fellow conservatives to get on board.
I see no reason why conservatives shouldn't support this. The only thing I think standing in the way is just sort of the status quo.
New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So your bill would give military prosecutors, rather than commanders in the chain of command, the power to decide which of these cases to try in military court. Now, other crimes in the military do go through this chain of command, which is to say that the commanders do have the power. Why should this crime, sexual assault, be any different?
Well, our bill actually recommends that all serious crimes be elevated and taken out of the chain of command. So rape will be handled the exact same way murder is handled. Because frankly, that's what our allies have done. The UK, Israel, Australia, Canada, Germany, all have removed serious crimes outside of the chain of command to create an objective military justice system that doesn't have command influence affecting the outcome.
Now, military leaders and other fellow senators of yours don't support this approach. Here's Major General Margaret Woodward, director of the U.S. Air Force Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Office. She spoke to NPR just a few days ago. Let's listen to what she has to say.
I am adamantly for operational commanders retaining the ability to be a part of the justice within their commands. And the reason for that is we're the ones responsible for the health and welfare of our airmen. And so removing the commander from the process, I think, will only make things more difficult.
Do you think this is a valid concern?
She's mistaken in her assessment that commanders are being removed from the responsibility to handle these cases. Only the commanders are responsible for ensuring good order and discipline. And they have to set a command climate where, first of all, these rapes and assaults aren't taking place. But if they do take place, that there is room for reporting and to assure that there's no retaliation. What we are finding, though, is that commanders in charge today are not assuring that for victims. 62% of victims who have reported their crimes report that they were retaliated against for reporting. So the person you interviewed was wrong in her assessment that they are going to be less involved or less responsible. Under the reforms that we have in place in the NDAA already, they are now being held accountable because, frankly, they've failed up until now to keep the command climate free of assault, rape, and retaliation.
Let me just ask about the issue of intimidation by superiors as a barrier to reporting sexual assault. Surveys show that that's not the only reason that people don't report, that another reason is that they don't understand what constitutes inappropriate sexual misconduct. How can the military address those issues?
Well, that comes down to basic training. I mean, obviously, members of the military need to understand what an actual assault is. They need to understand what consent is and what actually is a rape. But for most part, you know, these are violent crimes. There's no confusion. Of the 3,300 cases that were actually reported, 70% were violent assaults and violent rapes. Criminal conduct that is based on power and domination. These are not dates that have gone badly. These are not questions of whether she said yes, then no, then yes, then no. This is not an issue of hormones, as some of my colleagues have mentioned. These are violent crimes perpetrated by often predators who are recidivists, and these are crimes of domination and violence.
Let me just ask you, this is an uphill battle for you this summer. You have 51 votes now. If no one falters by the fall, when this will come up for a vote. You'll still have the House of Representatives to contend with. Why is this change in the military code of justice so important to you?
Because at the end of the day, commanders aren't objective. Commanders may have different training, different perspectives. They may or may not want women in the armed forces. They may not understand what sexual assault is or what constitutes rape. They may not agree what is a rape or not a rape. But that shouldn't be their judgment. It should be an objective, trained prosecutor who makes the decision about whether or not there is evidence to prosecute these crimes. That hopefully will instill more confidence in the system that justice can be possible.
Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, Senator from New York State, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. 150 years ago, the 54th Regiment Massachusetts Volunteer Infantry fought a historic battle in the Civil War. The unit was almost entirely African American. They would have been called colored back then. The first such unit from the North to fight for the Union. You might have seen their story depicted in the movie Glory with Denzel Washington.
I love the 54th. Y'all's the only family I got.
The assault on Fort Wagner took place in South Carolina on July 18, 1863. And we remember that battle here today with the help of historian Stephen Hill. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So tell me a little bit about the facts behind the 54th Regiment. Who were they? Who put them together?
The regiment was created by Governor John Andrew of Massachusetts. He was definitely an abolitionist. Immediately after the Emancipation Proclamation, he got authorization from the War Department to create regiments of black soldiers. He was not allowed to have black officers in those regiments. The call was put out throughout the North. There were plenty of men who were just waiting for this opportunity. They filled up the regiment with the 1,000 men required fairly quickly and then started another regiment because there was even an overflow.
Rob, is it true there's to be a colored regiment?
So it seems.
Then I am your first volunteer.
Who was their captain for the regiment, Robert Gouldshaw?
He was handpicked by Governor Andrew. And initially, he did have reservations about being in charge of a black regiment. It was one thing to say, I think these men ought to be allowed to fight like everyone else. It was another thing to say, I will stand up there in front of this regiment.
Mm-hmm. 54th Massachusetts requests the honor of leading the attack on Fort Wagner.
You and your men haven't slept for 2 days.
There's more to fighting than rest, sir. There's character. There's strength of heart.
The assault on Fort Wagner, it's in South Carolina. Why was it important?
It was important because it was one of the outlying fortifications around the town of Charleston, which was the impetus of the entire Civil War. Those were the people who first fired on the United States flag. So there was a great psychological need to assault and hopefully to capture Charleston, South Carolina.
So what was this unit, which had only been together at the time of this battle, just about 6 months, up against?
Well, they were up against a well-fortified and very determined enemy within the fort, which is bigger than the entire number of men in the 54th Massachusetts. But, of course, the 54th was not the only regiment attacking, but it was the lead regiment. When I've talked to this to, say, high school kids or something, they go, oh, my God, why would anybody want to be in the front? Well, it was important. It was the post of honor, and all his men appreciated that they were the ones that were going to be running right into the gunfire, and they were ready to go.
We want them to know that we went down standing up. We want them to know, Heavenly Father, that we died for freedom.
They took terrible casualties.
They did take terrible casualties. Shaw himself was leading the forward section of the regiment. He was up there on top of the wall and was pierced by several bullets almost at the same time, just as he was waving his sword and calling forward, saying something along the lines of, "Forward, my brave 54. And he dropped dead right at the foot of this flag of Massachusetts.
That was historian Stephen Hill from the National Museum of Health and Medicine in Silver Spring, Maryland. Stephen, thanks again.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now.
You're listening to what 500 million people watched, mesmerized, in black and white on their TV screens 44 years ago today in 1969. Astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin took their first steps on the moon.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Those historic boot prints from the Apollo 11 mission are actually still there, as are many other artifacts of America's space exploration. The last manned mission to the moon was in 1972. Two House Democrats want to preserve the site of the moon landing. They proposed a bill to create a National Historic Park on the moon. Yeah, you heard me right. To tell us if this is even possible is the director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University, Dr. Scott Pace. Dr. Pace, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what does current space law, I didn't even know there was such a thing, say about what countries can and cannot do in outer space?
Well, there actually is a body of international treaties, most of which were negotiated in the 1960s during the space race with the Russians, about what one can do in space. Probably the most important one is the 1967 Outer Space Treaty. Nations cannot claim sovereignty over celestial bodies, so you can't plant a flag on the moon and claim it for the United States.
So with this all in mind, can Congress create a National Historic Park on the moon?
The short answer is no.
I didn't think so.
The fundamental problem with the legislation is that it would arguably contravene international law. That being said, the issue that the legislation tries to address is, in fact, actually a real one. There are a number of historical sites on the moon that I think people would feel strongly about, not only American sites, but also Soviet and Russian sites. And arguably, there'll be other people there in the future.
And I guess what is actually still left behind on the surface of the moon is equipment, vehicles, things like that.
Right. The items that are on the moon are still U.S. government property. Protecting the hardware is not too hard. Protecting the historic sites, such as Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin's footsteps, which I think we would probably like to see preserved for all time, there is a way to do that. Basically, international law is whatever sovereign countries agree to. It can be a treaty. It could be simply a set of non-binding guidelines. But the key is that it be internationally recognized. So something that the U.S. does merely by itself is probably not going to be good enough.
People have certainly been talking about, in their own ways, recreating the Aldrin Armstrong moonwalk. Do you think that's a possibility, that tourists could conceivably intrude on this area?
Sure, but not just tourists with their own footsteps. Well, one could imagine robotically controlled rovers roaming around on the moon. There are even more advanced proposals for landing people on the moon, but I think those are actually quite a ways in the future. But robotic rovers on the moon, controlled by others who want to go and visit and sort of peer virtually at former lunar landing sites, that's certainly within the realm of possibility.
Is there any future, do you think, to human beings being in space, whether it's to create space colonies or do research or for any other reason?
The way I like to think of it is space has to be an answer to a question. Asking whether humans have a future is kind of like asking whether there's intelligent life in the universe. The answer is either yes or no. And either answer is really quite intriguing. Can we be a multi-planet species, or are we always going to be here on Earth? And I think the question breaks down into two parts. One is, can you live off the land, or do you always have to come home to Earth? And two, can you do anything to pay your way? And the purpose of exploration is to find out what kind of future, if any, humans have beyond the planet, as one of the more profound questions I think we can ask.
That was Dr. Scott Pace, the director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Fly me to the moon and let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, darling, kiss me.
South Florida has been irresistible for crime writers. Carl Hiaasen, Edna Buchanan, Harry Cruz are just a few who come to mind. But novelist John Dufresne hadn't really tried his hand at the noir genre before. Now he brings all his gifts for humor and pathos to Eden, Florida, the imaginary setting for the family slaughter that begins Dufresne's new novel, No Regrets, Coyote. It's a gripping read and off-kilter. He hails from Massachusetts originally, but Florida has gotten under his skin since a long time back. John Dufresne joins me from member station WLRN in Miami. Welcome.
Thank you, Jackie. Great to be here.
It's difficult to call a murder mystery fun, but No Regrets, Coyote is a fun murder mystery. And yet it starts with this really brutal, bloody crime. The entire Halliday family is killed in their home in South Florida. And an unlikely character is called in to help solve the crime. He's our protagonist, our hero. His name's Wiley Melville, nice writer's detective type name. He goes by Coyote. Tell us more about him. He's not actually a detective.
No, he's not. He's a therapist by trade. And he's called in occasionally because he has what a psychologist calls robust mirror neurons. He's able to sort of look at people and look at their furniture and look at the way they behave themselves and sort of determine, suss out what it is they're going on, what people's motivations are.
One of the great fun things in this that's sort of a send-up of the whole genre is that he often has to break off from solving the crime to, you know, basically give someone a therapy session because he's so caring.
Yeah, he does. He's carrying on with his business. It's like we all have our lives. Whatever trouble is going on in our life, we still have to live it. He has to go to work every day, and he has these clients that have various degrees of, you know, difficulty that he's trying to work with. And he's also got some problems in his own family with his father is suffering from dementia, and he has to take care of his father, and his sister is kind of hysteric, and he's trying to juggle all these things together at the same time while also losing his girlfriend and maybe finding another one, and all of this life goes on for him.
So the Halliday family, sadly, is no more, mom, pop, and three kids. And the cops insist that it's a murder-suicide, but Wiley, he just isn't so sure. Something doesn't seem right. This suicide note's pretty badly typed, and that's interesting. It's typed. It's found next to the father. Maybe you would give us a bit of that, please.
Yeah, okay. So he's given the suicide note that the police have found. He's handed it to it, and it reads like this. To whom it may concern. To start off about this tragic story, my name is Chafin Halliday, my wife Chrissy, and my boys Brantley, 9, Briley, 8, and my daughter and my precious angel Brianna, 4. People have put obstacles in my way and know who they are. I'm not insane, but this is no way to live like this. I have let my loved ones down. I have failed at fathership. I had to die. I deserved it, but to love them like I do and to live without them is too hard to bear, which is why we are dead. And why we are together on the other side. I could not leave my babies with strangers. Yours truly, Chafin R. Halliday.
Right away, Wiley suspects that there's just something off about all this. So Coyote's going to set off on this mission to find out what actually happened to this family. He's got a sidekick, and all good detectives need one. This is a poker player and magician type called Bay Latique. Tell us about Bay.
Well, Bay is a professional poker player who used to run an illegal poker game and would call Wiley in to see if anyone was cheating, if he could notice who it was, and it usually was, and it was usually cops, and they'd have to pay off the Police Benevolent Association so no one got in trouble. And Bay was also like his real estate attorney at one time and all that, and so now they're best buddies, and Wiley worries about Bay and the fact that he can't keep himself away from the poker table. But Bay is successful at it and makes his living that way.
Why don't you you read to us about Bay Latique?
Okay. My friend Bay Latique, a sleight-of-hand man, does close-up magic. You can shuffle a deck of playing cards, spread them face down on the table, and he'll pick them up in order, ace to king, by suit or by rank, your choice. He once asked me to think of a card, not to mention it, just to picture it. And he not only identified the card, he did it by asking me to open my wallet and pull out the $5 bill that had the rank and suit of the card written on Lincoln's shirt collar in red ink. 9 of diamonds. He can make a parakeet fly from his iPhone to your iPhone and from your iPhone to his shoulder. I've seen him slice a banana in half with the card he threw from 10 feet away. At least I think I saw it. Bay says close-up works this way. I tell you I'm going to lie to you, and then I lie to you, and you believe it because you want to believe.
I just love that. That just sends a chill up my spine. So, John Dufresne, this is your first crime novel, I believe. How did this come to be? You were part of a short story collection solicited from Florida writers?
Right. What happened was, you know, I had been writing what I like to think of as sort of literary fiction, for want of a better word, and I got an opportunity, a couple of opportunities actually, to write mystery stories with a collection called Miami Noir and then another one called Boston Noir. I've always written about mysteries, but the mystery is generally about, like, who are we, who are these other people, and why are we doing what we do? And this time the mystery is about not a venial sin in that sense, but a mortal sin, that there's crime and something has to be, a crime has to be solved. But I got to page 250 in the manuscript, and I didn't know who'd done it.
Doesn't somebody in here tell Wiley, I think he's about to board a plane somewhere. You know, that thing about Florida, it's not God's country.
I think so. Yes, I think that's right. It's a state trooper who pulls him over, and he says, yeah, I've been to Florida, and I didn't like it too much. He said, well, no, it's not God's country down there.
You know, I think you've given us someone here. You don't really want to say goodbye to the Coyote. I mean, he's a great character. Will we see him again?
Yes, we will. I'm working on him now, and he's actually in Nevada right now. And the manuscript that I was working on this morning, I've got him in. He's waking up in a motel in Valmy, Nevada. So the trouble's going to be in the desert, and I think we may end up coming back to Florida. But he and Bay are out in. They begin in Las Vegas, where Bay, of course, is at the poker table, and that's why they went.
Well, John, it has been a great pleasure talking to you. John Dufresne's new murder mystery is called No Regrets, Coyote. It is great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jackie.
And if you're just joining us, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden, and it's time now for music. In the 1980s, few bands showed where punk was headed more clearly than Minnesota's Husker Du. But the personalities in the trio wouldn't coexist beyond the decade. Guitarist Bob Mould went on to a successful recording career. Bassist Greg Norton dropped out of music and became a chef. And that leaves drummer Grant Hart. Since the end of Husker Du, Hart has either been incredibly productive or absent from the public eye for years at a time. Now, after 4 years away, he's back with an ambitious concept album, a double album even. It's based on an unpublished work by the late William S. Burroughs. Burroughs had adapted Milton's Paradise Lost and renamed it Lost Paradise. Is the sky the limit? What is the apogee? Is the sky the limit for me? Grant Hart's new album is called The Argument, and he joins us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio. Grant Hart, how nice it is to have you here.
Well, thank you very much.
This double album is a project that's been a long, long time in the making. How far back does it go?
Well, the actual inception goes back to 2008. William's secretary, James Grauerholtz, was poring over some unpublished things, looking for a project to be turned into a musical. And he showed me this Lost Paradise that William had monkeyed around with sometime last 10 years of his life. And by the time I left, I was convinced that I was the person that should compose the music for it.
So you knew him before his death in 1997?
It was a lot easier than knowing him after it. Yes, we'd known each other for about 11 years.
It seems like such an extraordinary adaptation of an adaptation. Was there something, a line that spoke to you, or just the concept of reinventing this yet again that gripped you? What was it?
Well, I've always been attracted to the line, awake, arise, or be forever fallen. You know, there's a revolutionary in me that really loves that kind of thinking.
Of course, Milton's poem is based on the biblical story of the fall of man. You're using a lot of different songwriting styles on these two albums. So Far From Heaven, for example, that had an almost 50s feel to me, a kind of Earth Angel by the Penguins or a Bobby Darin song.
Well, thank you very much. That's high praise. That was a favorite of my late mother's, and I love the fact that she was able to see that performed a few times.
I sit and watch the world alone from the star. I see you approaching. I wonder who you are. What's a little angel doing so far from heaven?
In your work, are you thinking about characters, Satan and Adam and the Archangel? Are you thinking, was anything in the poem informing your music?
Well, one of the early things that I decided was that Lucifer was not going to go through the name change, that I was going to not transform him from, you know, a sympathetic character to an evil character. I was going to excise the religious content, which is half of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're condensing something into a mere two records, 70 minutes worth of music, you got to chop a lot of Paradise Lost out. At first I thought, oh, I'm going to, you know, every detail, every comma, every exclamation point is going to be addressed. And as I went along, I realized that the songs in between the songs in between the songs are going to just pile up. So I started skipping around and then connecting the dots. And I think that's one of the things that made the project possible to conclude.
Yeah. Did you actually reread Milton or just the Burroughs poem when you tried to pair the mood of the music with the story you're telling in the lyrics?
I reread Milton. I had the Burroughs typescript until I had a house fire, which I had already stopped directly accessing this stuff. Instead, I took a lot in and then I channeled it. Once I knew what the story was going to be, I put the books away and told it my own way.
Hmm. My guest is Grant Hart, and his latest project is a double album based on Milton's Paradise Lost, and it's called The Argument. Let's talk a little bit about the song The Argument. You're using call and response here in the war between good and evil, and the lyrics are, never have I seen with so much pleasure, pleasure the result of so much beauty, beauty that is so enjoyed forever, ever we will seek it out in our being. And I love the way that you've doubled this, you know, the last line of the first refrain then becomes the springboard for the next line. Really, really clever wordplay. That had to be a real musical challenge.
It was a very tough challenge, and there's also a strange coincidence that happened there. In order to make an eight count with the lyric, I had to use 10 syllables per each line, and then they share two syllables, which makes it, you know, the metrical eight.
Mm-hmm.
And Milton's original was 10 syllables per line. And I didn't realize that until I very nearly completed writing the song. So I thought that was a nice tap on the shoulder from the fates.
Snake, you plead the argument to fight the print. If you receive the answer to my God and call him holy, you become that enlightened in my heart I warble praises.
You know, I read that you're thinking about staging it as what you have called a perverted ballet, and I'm almost afraid to ask how you do envision this on the stage.
Well, I see the core as a, you know, a rock band, and then I see additional instrumentation, a lot of voices, but there are places where I could see some kind of like exercise routine going on, or, you know, I'm not seeing Swan Lake. That's why I use the description perverted ballet. Courtney Love would be perfect because she's got the voice, she's got the delivery. You know, just ballet without the tutus, maybe space suits.
Maybe a trampoline for the fall thing, you know.
A trampoline?
Satan and Lucifer can go up and down with sin and death.
Bungee cords.
Feel free to take my contributions here.
Yes.
Put away your poisonous dart. There's nothing to cure in this angel's heart.
Grant Hart was one-third of the legendary rock band Husker Du. His new solo album comes out on Tuesday. It's an adaptation of Milton's Paradise Lost, and it's called The Argument. Check out a few tracks on our website, nprmusic.org. Grant Hart, it really has been fun to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And for the week ending July 21st, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Becky Sullivan, Liz Baker, Amy Held, Elliot Hannon, and Rachel Rue. Jan Stewart is our intern. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Mathoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai, our senior producer. I'm Jackie Lydon. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.